You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
I'm Leanne, and I'm joined by my new co-host, Tom.
Hiya, I'm Tom.
Yep. So we're your new hosts for the revamped Anfield Index Writers Podcast. For any new listeners, that this is a podcast that looks at, you know, some of the most recent articles on the site and discusses the points behind them and the points that they raise. So today with us is Carl Kopak. Carl is a writer for Anfield Index and the Anfield Wrap. And he's here to talk about his recent article on Alberto Moreno and his woeful miss at the weekend against West Brom. So, Carl, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me on. Very kind of you.
So, pleasure's all mine. So let's dive straight into the article on Moreno then. Could you give us a quick overview of the article, your thought process in writing it, and, you know, your overall take?
Yeah, it's in two parts, really. Firstly, I talk about the miss itself. And, you know, what Alberto Moreno was thinking, the context of the game. Did he have better options? What would we have done in that situation? And then it leads on to either the overzealous support for Alberto Moreno or the over-criticism of him, which I'm guilty of, the latter. And it's about... It extends to basically the fact that I didn't know what Jurgen Klopp had said because I was travelling back from the game. And when I commented that I thought that Alberto Moreno is, I mean this nicely, an idiot, people were basically calling me an expert, a so-called expert, and how dare I go against Jurgen Klopp. And then so I basically just, the last half is basically a rant with me saying how much I hate certain phrases which are used by Liverpool fans, so-called fans, so-called experts, armchair fans, bloggers. I don't really see myself as a blogger, to be honest, but so it's an extension of two pieces, really. It was just basically, as I tend to write about things that have annoyed me during the week or things that make me very happy during the week, and this was a case in point. I wrote it on Monday, which was just as well, because if I'd written it on Sunday night, I would have broken several expletive rules, probably, of the Anfield Index, if there are such a thing.
You know, as you say there, you sort of touched on it. The reaction did seem to be a bit of a mixture of, you know, anger and bemusement at the fact that he made the decision that he did. You know, Sturridge is running through on the left. You've got Chan and Firmino. Surely he's got to square that ball. You know, it's a great chance to close the game off. Tom, I'm coming to you here. What's your take on that?
Well, I think Carl's got a really good grasp on it. I did write my match review on the Sunday night, and I remember when I wrote my match review, I was absolutely fuming with Moreno. I was one of those who immediately was so angry at how A, how poor the finish was, but B, his decision-making process. And since then, you know, I've had a bit of time to calm down. But I mean, to be fair, my reaction wasn't overly serious, but I do feel as though he just had to play it to Chan, just square it to Emre, let Emre run in. There was so much time left on the hook. Even if he just run the other way, you know, even if he just run towards the goal or knocked it backwards, you know, just taking more time off, it was the fact that he did arguably the worst possible thing at a moment when it was so pivotal in the match that really frustrated me about it. But I mean, looking back, yes, Sturridge was offside looking back. And yeah, in that situation, I think most players probably would have done the same thing. And it's frustrating. And I think Carl made one really good point during the game, that it was just the fact that Moreno had just come on and immediately felt like he ruined so much of the hard work that other players had done. And that was one that really connected with me. I do agree with Carl on the general discussion as well. I find people who criticise, when you criticise anything Jurgen Klopp does, a lot of people get really defensive. And it's like, that I do take their point that, you know, Klopp is the manager and, you know, sometimes you just have to trust him. But that doesn't mean that everything he does is, you know, has to be taken as gospel. Otherwise, there'd just be no discussion.
But it was more than that, I thought, because he didn't actually say anything. All he said was, you know, the lad missed and, you know, we're moving on. And I didn't even know he said that. You know, so I wasn't even criticising the manager, not just because he didn't miss the goal for a start, Moreno did. It was the fact that people were annoyed with me, but because they thought there was a link with me criticising Moreno, which I'm more than happy to do, to criticising the manager. And the fact, well, there is no leap there at all. Klopp did nothing wrong, but I just find it really interesting that people just say, if you criticise the slightest thing, you're having a dig at the manager. There was somebody said to me a few months ago about Jurgen Klopp, he will leave because of people like you. But Jurgen Klopp doesn't know who I am. He's got no idea. So, you know, and I like Jurgen Klopp. I'm a big Jurgen Klopp fan, but he will get things wrong occasionally. And it just really angered me that me saying Alberto Moreno was a fool for what he did, because he had several options. As I said in the piece, in the ground, I didn't know Sturridge was offside because I was really low down behind the goal. But I knew Chan wasn't. And to be honest, what I wanted to do was take 5 to 10 more yards, which he had, and he could have done that. And then he can't really miss. I don't think he can miss anyway, because as I say in the piece, he's got to go for the centre. You can go for the centre of the goal because there is literally nobody there. You don't have to aim for a corner as you would if there was a keeper there. You can go into the middle. And the fact that out of all those things, he chose he didn't actually choose the wrong option. He was just no good at the option he chose. And the fact that I criticised him for that automatically came, you think you know more than the manager. And that just drives me insane. It really does. And then I became a so-called expert. Not me, actually. Another friend of mine was described as the so-called experts because he was making the same points as me. And sometimes you've got to stand up and say, I'm not criticising the manager, I'm criticising the player. But that's okay because I wasn't the man who missed an open goal from 20 yards. So... absolutely maddened me.
Do you think it was a case of, you know, as you say, Moreno's just come on, he hasn't had much game time lately. Is it a case of him seeing his name? I know, I'm not defending him, but is it a case of him seeing his name up in lights? You know,
that's exactly what it was for me. I think it was a case of, there's an expression I really like in American politics, which is getting back into the game with one swing. Where I like the West Wing a lot, and they say it in the West Wing when one of the characters, CJ, does something wrong. And then she tries to basically wipe away the shame she's had by doing one massive, enormous thing, getting into the game with one swing. And I think he's gone clear. And I think there's a thing in his mind where he said, if I score this goal, I'm Alberto Moreno, the hero, not the bloke who was really bad at the start of the season, particularly at the Emirates, and gives away lots of stupid penalties and things. I'm Alberto Moreno, the hero. And that's what angers me, because Alberto Moreno, the hero, would have been the man who would have passed to a better man or scored. And there was so much teamwork, and I'm going to be talking about your article, Leanne. There's so much teamwork in that performance, which was outstanding. And for him to come on and think, right, this is all about me for a second, that really annoyed me. Can't prove that, obviously, but that was my take of it.
You've also both raised some really interesting ideas on, you know, the criticism and support of Klopp. Do you think it's maybe a case people are in awe of the fact we now have this world-class manager? You know, it's no longer the Roy Hodgson, the Brendan Rodgers, with all respect to him. We've now got someone who can lead us into Europe, who can lead us, hopefully, to a title. Tom, I'm going to go to you here first. Do you think that comes in when, you know, you're looking at people saying, oh, don't criticise him, don't do this? People just want him to stay. They're very protective of him because he's that world-class manager we've been looking for.
I think that's definitely a part of it, Leanne. And I mean, that's one of the things that kind of annoys me, because, you know, if you said anything wrong about Brendan, you'd get so many retweets. People would be so up for it. They'd be so popular. Because Brendan was a really popular person for people to beat a stick at, because people didn't like Brendan. And maybe it's just because he wasn't that popular. Maybe it's just because, you know, I think the problem with Brendan was he had one or two results that just made him really easy to target. Whereas I think I love Brendan Rodgers. It kind of frustrates me how even now, if you say something really nasty about Brendan, you'll get so popular. Whereas the general opinion is that Klopp can do no wrong. And that kind of bugs me a bit, because it's like we're treating Klopp very differently to the way we've treated previous managers, as you pointed out. I mean, Roy Hodgson is a different one. I'm not going to stand here and defend Roy Hodgson, because I don't, even if I thought it was the right thing to do, I physically couldn't bring myself to do it. But I think, yeah, a lot of people don't want Klopp to leave. A lot of people don't want Klopp, but they also feel like if someone like Klopp can make mistakes, is there any hope almost? Like, you know, to some extent, for a lot of people, they've never had a manager arguably as high profile or as good as Jurgen Klopp at this club. And for maybe a lot of Liverpool fans, they don't feel like if Klopp leaves, without making significant progress, we're ever going to get a manager as good as Jurgen Klopp again. So, you know, to them, he's the first manager maybe in their lifetimes for a lot of fans, maybe just in a long time for others, where, you know, he's almost above criticism because of how good he is, because of the good he does for this club. Whereas even in 2013-14, if you were to insult Brendan for this, that and the other, that would be almost okay. So I do feel like there is a double standard with managers, which maybe has some, you know, valid reasoning behind it. Klopp is, you know, a double Bundesliga winning manager. You know, he has earned this respect, but at the same time, that doesn't necessarily fully negate, in my opinion, the kind of double standard it is there. I mean, personally, I'm a massive Jurgen Klopp fan, and I massively get behind the idea that we should support the manager, especially when it is someone like Jurgen Klopp. But I also do think that that kind of standard should be related to other managers as well. You know, I don't. If there are people out there who, you know, go by the philosophy, we should always support the manager, whatever happens, whoever that manager is, I'm 100% behind that. That's personally one of my opinions to an extent. Then if there are others who, you know, say the manager is open for criticism, whatever he does, whenever he does it, and we should always be criticizing the manager, that's also fine. My issue is when you have certain fans who don't judge a manager on what they've done or what they're doing at the club, but on who that manager is. And maybe that's an issue with Jurgen Klopp. Maybe it isn't to the same extent, but I do think it's something that needs to be maybe considered when people say, you know, we should or shouldn't criticise Klopp. That's just my opinion on it.
I think it's creepy, to be honest. I really do. I think that the overzealous support of the manager, and there's nothing wrong with supporting the manager, because I support managers because they're trying to do things that I want them to do. But sometimes I just think, when I read things like, I mean, for example, the January transfer window, there was somebody who said, and someone I massively respect said, if you think that we're going to be buying people in January, then you don't understand Jurgen Klopp, which basically meant you don't understand Jurgen Klopp as well as I do. Like they want to be some part of a club, or, you know, I've got this level of insight that only Jurgen and I share, and you're a non-believer. And it just made me think, he's the manager of the club. We get behind the manager of the club because we want to win things. It isn't, you know, we build statues of this club far too early. I like the man, but he hasn't started yet. And that's a huge thing for me. And again, I will say, I wasn't even criticising the manager because I didn't even know the manager had spoken about this at all at that point. I was stuck on a train. But we build statues far too early. We really do. And to go from me saying, I think that Alberto Moreno made a massive mistake, to how dare you criticise Jurgen Klopp, is a hell of a leap. And I think that's indicative of elements of our support, to be honest. And I find that really frustrating. Particularly when they come up with terms like so-called experts.
Oh, that is such an annoying phrase, isn't it? It really is. So, yeah. I mean, we're all watching the same game here. No one's claiming to be an expert. We're all just giving our opinions on a game of football. And some of us do have more understanding than others, but that we're not claiming to be experts. We're just claiming to have a reasonable idea of what's going on.
Like, I'm disagreeing with the people. There's my mate to my left at the match and a man I was talking to my right. We watched the same things and we all came up with three different arguments about it. Doesn't mean no one was right. Well, I was right. there's major things about our support which drive me mad, and that was the one that really got to me on Sunday.
Yeah. I think for me, you know, the whole FSG thing is a perfect summary of it. Really, you know, the lack of action in the January window, lots of people blaming FSG totally. You know, Linda gets taunted on Twitter. I think it was yesterday. Yeah, again, it just shows they're taking the brunt of the blame. Yet, you know, I personally fail to believe Klopp didn't have any backing.
Oh, sorry, can I just come back to that for a second, Leanne? She said she did the thing I don't like. Even though I agreed with her tweet to that bloke, she put fans in inverted commas. Oh God, come on! Don't you start doing it? You won the club, for God's sake.
To be fair, I think there is a difference between, you know, saying so-called fans for criticising someone and, you know, asking someone, are you really a fan of the club, if you're, you know, actively abusing, you know, the owners and stuff on Twitter. You know, I get it's not, you know, I get it's still not great, but I do think it is slightly different, you know?
Slightly.
Yeah.
But I criticise the owners all the time. I wouldn't tweet Linda for 50, but no. But yeah, it did make me laugh when I thought that she put fans in inverted commas. Right. There we go. No, but as for FSG, I don't know, really. This is a different point than I could, and we probably won't go into it because I could just speak for hours on this. I think we really blew this season in January. I think a decision should have been made in November. Are we going to try and go for this or not? And we decided not to go for it.
Okay. I think we're getting a little bit off topic with that one. So I'll just move us on to the next bit. And the next article we were going to discuss is Leanne's article. So I'm going to be taking the lead on this one. And this was about the grit and the steel and guts and Liverpool showing a different side to their game. And I'll let Leanne take control of this one. So Leanne, talk us through your article.
Yeah, for me, you know, the last two games have really summarised, you know, what my article is trying to put forward, basically, that, you know, it hasn't been vintage Liverpool performances by any means. And, you know, especially against West Brom, it's never going to be the type of place where you can play your tiki-taka football and, you know, play pretty football. But I think a massive credit has to go to Klopp and the players for adapting the system. You know, Stoke, we kind of played three at the back at some points. And, you know, we've mastered the art of winning ugly in recent times. And hopefully we can keep that up, because I think if you're pushing for the things like the title and for cups, you need that ability to do so. And I think Emre Can is the perfect indication of how we've established that grittiness, that steel in midfield.
Yeah, okay. So, so Carl, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, how did you rate Emre Can's performance, and how did you rate the general, you know, the general team performance, and what Klopp's tactics were in this sort of game?
Well, I'll say first of all that if Alberto Moreno had not been on the pitch and that incident never happened, I would have written Leanne's article. That's exactly what I was going to write. That's what I was thinking on the way home. I think Emre Can infuriates me from time to time, but in the last few weeks, he's really changed. Really, really changed. And the level of commitment he's shown from about Man City onwards has just been astonishing. He got a really, really bad kick on the shin really early on in this game, got up with his next tackle, because that's what he does now. There are things against Emre Can. I still don't think he can turn when the ball goes behind him at pace. But when he plays two behind a one in a midfield three, I think he's absolutely imperious. He was fantastic. And the team performance itself, I said in mine actually that people will look back at this season and talk about the wins against City and Arsenal and the big games we played. But the last 6 points have just been absolutely enormous for Liverpool. And they are indicative of a Liverpool side that is showing things that we haven't shown in a while, particularly since about 2010. something like that. And that's delightful for someone as old as me to see. Because you're rightly on, because it wasn't a vintage performance, but in some ways it really was, because this is what we used to do. We used to play some beautiful football. But if you want to drag us down and make things dirty, God, we can play dirty. And we've had to play dirty in the last two games, because West Brom were just thugs on Sunday. They really were. And it's fine, because, you know, if you're trying to win a war, you use the weapons that are to hand, and they're all really, really tall, and they like high balls into the box, and they wanted to run through Emre, and they wanted to get through Lucas, and we just stood there and took it. And I was as happy as that as I was at the scoreline from the end of
that
game.
I think as you just touched on, you know, players like Coutinho, especially when he first came into the club, he was being pushed over and bullied in games like this. And so it makes it all the more satisfying to see us able to go toe-to-toe with a team like Tony Pulis's side. You know, they're known for their physicality, and so often we've seen, you know, Liverpool just can't deal with it sometimes because we've got the small, more agile players. But, you know, I think that's what makes performances like this almost, as you say, sort of better than the wins against, you know, the likes of Arsenal, because it's way more satisfying to see, you know, we're capable of doing that. And as I said earlier, that is exactly what you need when you want to be competing for things.
Well, the nicest thing for me was, I've been to the Hawthorns lots of times, and this was the first time where I've heard the West Brom fans make out that we were the dirty team. I loved that. That was really, really nice. Then they were singing about how, their words, they only get shit refs. I thought, oh, that's good, because that basically means that you get a lot of decisions for elbows and sneaky trips and the dark arts of football, and now it's going against you because we're doing it as well. But that was really nice to see. And again, I said in my piece that, you know, if you were looking for a man of the match, we discussed it on the way home and being my mates, and the entire midfield, we just absolutely mastered that game, and I don't think we were capable of doing that last season. Although strangely, it's about a year today, in fact, that around this time that Emre Can was great, and then he sort of fell backwards a bit, and now he's playing like this. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. So I want to move slightly away from Emre Can, who is a player I'm a massive fan of. I was one of those people in January and February, you know, egging on Can. But moving away from Can and moving on to some of the more positive aspects. Defensively, was it good? And I'll stick with you on this one, Carl, for the moment, and then we'll go to Leanne in a minute. But Carl, was it good to see Dejan Lovren and Joel Matip back together as a two, and, you know, behind them, see Mignolet playing well? Do you think that stable, settled back three had a massive impact on the final performance and the final result?
Yeah, I don't mind Clavin, to be honest, but he's only good for five games, then he really drops off. He's not the youngest man in the world. I really like Dejan Lovren. I don't care what anyone says, honestly. I think he makes mistakes, but sometimes I think that's because of the midfield in front of him. But as a partnership, it's the one that works in the club, isn't it? They've only played, what, 13 times together, which is ridiculous if you think about the amount of games we play. And it just works because Lovren does the dirty stuff and Matty brings it out. I mean, Matty was practically playing centre midfield for a while, particularly when Lucas kept dropping back on Sunday. But you need, when you have a central defensive partnership, you need them to cover every aspect of defending between them. So, for example, Hippier and Hensho, as Phil Thompson used to say, if it's in the air, it's Sammy's. If it's on the ground, it's Stefan's. And I think we've got something similar here now. They're nowhere near as good as those two, but at least not yet. But I just think it works because Lovren is a leader. He shouts a lot, which I really like. Matic's more calm and laid back and brings the ball out, which I'm normally against, to be honest, because things like that petrify me. But with Lucas dropping in between back to them as well, I thought it just worked really well. And the keeper looked more confident because of it as well. And more importantly, they had confidence in the keeper. So when Mignolet had to make that big save, which was a mistake from the centre-backs, you know, because they just got around the back of them, then they knew he was going to be okay. They knew he could do something. So, and that was massive. And again, going to a place like the Hawthorns and having if we've had a weaker performance than that, we would have been in trouble.
Yeah, agreed. So we'll go to you now, Leanne. And we're going to just want to briefly talk on the other aspect of the game and talk about the attacking front three. So do you think that this was a performance where, you know, how the teams behind them played impacted that front three's own steel? Do you think the front three showed, you know, the same kind of guts or determination? Or do you think the likes of Coutinho and Origi, for example, in particular, do you think they struggled with this side of the game, or do you think they embraced it as well as the players behind them?
Just quickly, I'd like to point out that I actually really like Lovren as well. I thought I was the only one, so that was quite good to hear.
This is a first for any podcast on any Liverpool station ever, where two people have said that Dion Lovren is good at the same time. That's never happened.
I'll quickly make that three. I actually really like Dejan Lovren as well. I don't think he's a world-class centre-back, but I think he's a good partner for Matip. And I think I'd be more than happy having him as our third-choice centre-back next season.
As for the forward three, as you said, I think actually Origi had a very good game. He'll go probably under the radar with what he did, but you know, he held the ball up well. He was physical. It's always going to be hard to lead the line by yourself against a team like West Brom, but I thought he did it, you know, admirably. He struggled maybe initially to get into the game, but
he got kicked to pieces.
For me, you know, at the start he did. Yeah, I didn't think he was good to begin with, but I think he grew into the game. And you know, as I said, everyone's going to struggle when they're up against just a straight back four of Toni Pulis's side. So, you know, if you're looking at our other options, Daniel Sturridge is still not really fit, so he's not going to do a job like that. We don't really have a player who can stand up against back four. And I think Origi is the closest thing that we have to that. And, you know, it's not his game, but he did it well. He adapted well for me. I think there are a couple of times, yes, he was wasteful in possession, but all in all, he held it up well, brought others into the game and relieved some pressure on the defence.
Okay, that's a good point, Stelian. So we'll move back to you quickly, Carl, because I do want to talk about it. For me, it's impossible to talk about, you know, a gutsy, gritty, West Brom-y performance against West Brom, and not to mention the fact that we scored the winning goal off a set piece. You know, it was, for all the talk about how West Brom, I went into that game thinking West Brom are definitely going to score from a corner or a free kick, but West Brom ended up not having many set pieces, and we ended up scoring off one. So what do you make of the set piece element of it, Carl?
Lucas, that flick on ball is beautiful. It's so nice. But we said it in the time of the ground, did he mean that? Because it's the other end of the ground from where we were. Did it hit his shoulder or something? But if you watch it again, as he flicks it on, he's looking to see where his mate is straight away. And I think they tried something before. We'd had a free kick from a similar position a few minutes earlier, and nothing came of that. So it's obviously something they tried. So I think it's a really clever idea. If you're going to put the ball in the middle, there's a chance we're not going to win that ball because they're all 9'6" tall and we're not. So I think making the second ball be just outside the area, I think was really clever. And it's a nice finish as well, by the way. Firmino's finish on that's really good. His heading is very underrated, I think.
Yeah, he's a really good header of the ball. He's scored a couple of good headers this season against Swansea in particular.
Yeah.
So we've got
same goal, isn't it? Is that the same as the Swansea goal? It is the away goal. It's Henderson's
similar.
Yeah, it's the same sort of across the box, and then he's just facing the goalkeeper. That was a really great goal.
Yeah, so we'll finish this discussion with you, Leanne, and use that as a segue into our last discussion. So, some on Mignolet's performance in this game. He pulled off the good save, but other than that, he dealt really well with the aerial physical presence of West Brom, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think, you know, we touched on earlier how you wouldn't really expect this kind of performance from a Liverpool team of late. And I think along with that, you wouldn't have expected Simon Mignolet's performance because, you know, he so often flaps at long balls. He struggles with crosses. But in that game, you know, he was punching. He was, you know, authoritative. He was the leader at the back, as Carl mentioned earlier. And you know, I'm one of his biggest critics. I don't think he should be number one, as we'll come on to talk about in your article next. But, you know, I thought he dealt well with the physicality. You know, he makes a great save as well. And it showed how far he's come of late.
OK, Carl, before we move on, Carl, any thoughts on Mignolet?
There was something he did at the end, which I really, really liked. At the end of the game, when they're all getting their hugs off Jürgen and stuff, he broke away and ran. He was the first person to run to the away end. Clenched his fists in joy, a really aggressive celebration, as in that really meant something to him. And I've not seen him do that for a while. And I thought, that's a man who's grown in confidence, because I thought he was great. I mean, in terms of man of the match, he's in with a shout, to be honest. Although he really didn't have much to do other than the save and stuff. But I just thought his aggression and particularly if you put that in context of what he did last week at Stoke, which was phenomenal, frankly, then, yeah, I thought he was a man of the match candidate. I thought he was brilliant. Well, they all were. Apart from one person. But let's not talk about him again.
Tom, you've recently written an article on this yourself, haven't you? About whether, you know, this upturn in form, it's obviously very pleasing and it comes at a great time for Liverpool with the race for top four. But, you know, there's still that question, has he got what it takes to be our number one next season? Should we be going into the summer window thinking of a new keeper? Talk us through your article.
Yeah, so I've been sitting on this one for about a week. I was really tempted to write it after the Stoke game where he pulled off, you know, but he was absolutely unreal against Stoke, don't get me wrong. But then again, after this game, it felt like the timing was off. But for me, I didn't want to wait until he turned in a bad performance, because then it just seems like I'm being petty. Because I do think this has to be taken, for me, with a pinch of salt. This is Simon Mignolet who's turned in two really good performances in the last 2 weeks. And I've actually been really impressed with Mignolet for the entire time that he's been back having his number one jersey since just before Christmas. I think he's turned in a really good 4 months of form. So I don't want to come across as being someone who's underappreciating what he's doing for the club at the moment. But the main point of the article for me is just that it's too late for him. I just think that this is Mignolet's fourth season at the club, and this is the first season where he's not been actively a liability. Like, up until this point, Mignolet's career at Liverpool has been very, very shaky. He's basically been our goalkeeper. This is the fourth year of him being our goalkeeper. He's basically still our goalkeeper because we haven't been able to replace Pepe Reina. We've not been able to bring in anyone better than Mignolet. And I like Mignolet. I think he's clearly a really good guy, really a committed guy. And I was really, really impressed with his temperament when he was dropped, because it became clear that he loves this club and he wants to give his all for the club. But I don't think he's a world-class goalkeeper. And I don't think it's a controversial statement to say Mignolet isn't a world-class goalkeeper. And I don't think it should be a controversial statement to say Mignolet is not one of the top four or five goalkeepers in the league. And Liverpool want to be competing for the Premier League title. We want to be getting into the Champions League regularly. And we want to arguably be competing to win the Champions League at some point in the next 3 or 4 years. You know, clearly the middle term goal for Klopp is to at least challenge for everything. And I don't think you can win the Premier League with Simon Mignolet in goal. That's just, for me, that's the be all and end all of it. I like Mignolet, but I don't think he's good enough. I mean, he's 29 now. You know, is he going to improve as a goalkeeper as he comes into his prime? Plausibly. But I don't think there's enough there to suggest that he's going to significantly improve on where he is. And I don't think two performances is enough. And so what I said in the article was basically, Lloris Karius is 23. He's 6 years younger than Mignolet. And I don't think he's a significantly worse goalkeeper even now, as it stands. I think you could throw Karius straight into the side without a significant drop down. So I think Karius should be getting the game time to develop himself next season. And whether or not that means Mignolet stays at the club as a cup keeper, or whether or not we sell Mignolet and bring in a world-class experienced keeper, that's not for me to say. But what I do think, for me at the least, is clear, is that if we want to win major trophies, despite what's been a really good few weeks for Mignolet, that cannot be allowed to cloud the fact that he's not good enough to be a Premier League winning keeper.
Yeah, you touched on, in the article, I think for me it was very poignant that you touched on this issue of trust. Carl, do you think that's a big factor? You know, Mignolet, you touched on it earlier, you know, the defence having confidence in him. But for me, actually, what has made this might sound quite harsh, what has made his recent performances so good is you wouldn't be expecting him to make those saves. You wouldn't be expecting him to be punching the ball from balls into the box and, you know, hoofing it into the box. You'd think he'd be struggling and flapping at it like he used to be. So is it that issue of trust and that lack of trust that inevitably means Liverpool need to strengthen, they need to look elsewhere?
Well, I mean, for a start, I've always said this about Mignolet. If I'd rather trust him in a man taking an unstoppable 30-yard shot against him, I'd rather have him face a one-on-one than have him face a corner, and that's not great. And Liverpool, we have a history of getting goalkeepers who can do one but not the other. And I think, to be honest, that's also the problem with the other clubs as well. Joe Hart's a major case of that. People think Joe Hart's brilliant, but I'd score against Joe Hart eventually, just because he's always got that. He can't save. I think he's very good at everything else, but you know, I will score a one-on-one at some point against Joe Hart. And Mignolet, his issue's been the other way around. He's been a phenomenal goalkeeper at times for Liverpool, but occasionally he'll throw the ball into the net. Hull, for example, away was or I don't even, still annoys me. Still annoys me, that girl, what he's doing there. But as for trust, I think it's a case of, do you assess it as if things are now or how they've been? Because when you say he's 29, 29 is no bad age for a goalkeeper at all. Because the next 7 years, which he's got, could see him step up. Because all goalkeepers, I mean, Karius is an example. I don't see the Karius thing at all. I really don't. But I know he's only young and everything, but I'd rather not watch him improve on a granular level over the next 10 years for Liverpool and him be average when he's 30. I don't want to see that. Do we need to replace Simon Mignolet? I think there are more important things to replace, but I'd really want a 10-year Liverpool goalkeeper, because it seems to me that's how you win leagues. You have your goalkeeper and they never change. Check at Chelsea. Courtois now. De Gea, hopefully he might go to Real Madrid, but you know. I think it's telling that United never really replaced Schmeichel. And of course, they won things because, you know, their midfield was amazing, but you need a big personality to someone and say, number one, you shouldn't have to think who's the goalkeeper going to be next week. If you're in that situation, and we've chopped and changed it a lot this season, and I think they've both been as bad as each other. And Karius has got the excuse because he's young, but Mignolet's my first choice at the moment. I wouldn't break down in tears if Mignolet wasn't the goalkeeper, but I don't think I'd be overly bothered if he wasn't, to be honest, because I think he is improving. And I think he may finally have found the manager for him. I think we may have a team now, because no one criticises the goalkeeping coaches, and we're awful with our goalkeepers. To be honest, people say Rayner was great, but Pepe Reina's last 2 years at Liverpool were pretty much a disgrace. He was awful those last 2 years. The cup final goal, he did that thing where he went down on one knee and always left his near post exposed. And, you know, he was living on his reputation a bit. But I think if Mignolet continues the way he is, then I think we might have a goalkeeper. And I'm not sure I'd want to change that.
I was at that whole game myself. I thought, you know, as you said, it was a really bad performance from Mignolet and a massive mistake. And when you think that was just 2 months ago, there's definitely an issue of consistency regarding Mignolet. You know, he is turning in now some brilliant performances, but he's yet to do that across a whole season since he's been here. And Tom, you touched on it quite strongly in your article. I think, you know, he's a great shot stopper and no one ever denies that, but has he got that consistency?
No, for me, he hasn't shown he's got that consistency yet. And I think you're absolutely right. But here I have a few issues with me. I think Carl touched on something that really, really speaks to me, which is that we want a goalkeeper who's going to be around for 10 years. And do I look at Simon Mignolet being a top class keeper for the next 5-10 years? I really don't. I just don't see it. You know, at the moment, he's turned in a handful of good performances, but you never know when that next mistake is coming. It's only been, you know, 2 months, 3 months since he made that really bad error against Chelsea that cost us a goal in that game. Admittedly, you know, he redeemed himself by saving a penalty that day, but he's not always going to be able to redeem himself by saving a penalty. Stoke before Christmas, I thought he really should have done better. Even at the start of the season, you know, he made three or four really big errors in our first three games. You know, the mistakes are still there. He's not had a mistake-free season. He's had two good games. And I mean, it's been brought up, but, you know, should he have done better in some of the most recent games against Bournemouth? Maybe he should have done better with that. With maybe the Josh King one, should have anticipated it better. Admittedly, you know, it was a wretched back pass, but should he have done maybe slightly better with that one? You know, he still doesn't look comfortable coming out for one-on-ones. And I think my issue with Mignolet is that he's had two games where he's played as well as a Courtois, as a Lloris, as a De Gea. For two games, he's turned in a performance that is somewhere near the level that you would expect from a goalkeeper who is going to be at the top level to turn in, week out, you know? And he's never done it week in, week out. And I mean, I know, I'm Carl, you say you don't see the thing about Karius, but, you know, he was one of the most talented goalkeepers in the Bundesliga when we signed him. You know, he was in the top three or four bracket for the Bundesliga for that season. So clearly, Klopp sees something in him. And I think, you know, could Karius be the goalkeeper to see us through the next decade? I don't know, but I don't think he's going to progress gradually. I think if you give Karius an entire season with the number one shirt, you can make a decision. You know, give Karius an entire season in the Premier League, give him the number one shirt, and then if by the end of the season he hasn't improved, we need to replace him, you know. But if he had, if by the end of next season, I think Karius could be a top class goalkeeper, give him if you give him an entire season to develop. And that's what I think we need to do. We can't keep falling back on Mignolet. We can't keep falling back into this mediocre keeper who's occasionally upping his game, you know. And I think it's too late for him. I just think it's such a massive gamble to give ourselves another year of Mignolet, knowing that the next mistake could so easily be around the corner. I still think he's shown lapses in judgment. I mean, I mentioned in the article, the Dejan Lovren thing. I got a bit of stick for suggesting that he shouldn't have picked up Lovren's knee. But to me, my gut reaction when Lovren nudged it back to him was that was a back pass.
No, it was legal
because Lovren miscontrolled it. But my gut reaction was, did he mean to do that? You know,
I thought he did, to be honest, because he was running right back. I was literally 10 yards away. He was running right back at me. And I thought he did that on purpose, which is why everyone around us went, really? He's done that on purpose.
Exactly.
We didn't know in the ground. I found out afterwards that it's a perfectly legal move. You can do it.
It is, but Mignolet should have been more careful. You know, if Mignolet's not 100% sure, because I'm not sure how he could be 100% sure, and more importantly, if Mignolet can see that the ref might not be 100% sure, he shouldn't be picking it up. You know what I mean? Like, even if there's some doubt in his mind or in the referee's mind, you know, he should not be picking that up. He should, because he had time to take a touch and just put his foot through it. And that's the kind of thing what I mean by these lapses in judgment that he does seem to show and that never seem to go away. You know, he showed a real lapse in judgment against Chelsea, he showed lapses in judgment against Hull. You know, it just feels to me like even when he goes a few games without mistakes, that same mistake is never far away. That's what it feels like to me.
Ordinarily, yeah, but not at the moment. I don't think he made a mistake at all picking the ball up, because I thought he had time to do it and I thought he knew what he was doing. But I think the problem I've got with it, if you put Karius in goal for a year and he's still untried and he's, let's face it, he's not exactly lit up the ground since he's been there, aren't you just basically making the same point about Mignolet, where you think you've got to watch your man develop and it could cost us a league, which, you know, that clearly could happen with Mignolet. I mean, don't get me wrong, if someone says to me, if the club said tomorrow, we're going to buy this lad, he's brilliant, he's 25, and he's only conceded 4 goals this season, and he's going to be our goalkeeper for 10 years, and he's streets ahead of the other two, then I'm fine with that. That's what I want. I think what I'm basically saying is, and I think Mignolet's really improved, and I do think he deserves a chance. I know he's had chances, but never from this level that he's at the moment. I don't think either of them are good enough for Liverpool, to be honest. But I've never seen Mignolet improve to this level ever. So I don't know if this is just a flash in the pan or he's finally stepping up. Because players do that sometimes. Sometimes we spoke at Emre Can. And Emre Can can be crap. I thought he was crap in his first 3 months here. But suddenly you arrive at a level. And it is a gamble because we don't know where we are with this. But at the moment, I'm not happy with either of them, to be honest. What's happened to Alex Maniger in all this as well? Because if he's third choice Liverpool goalkeeper, and there was a time when everyone had decided that Mignolet was no good and Karius was no good, people instantly started talking about Danny Ward and do we bring him back and, you know, give him a go, as we did at Bournemouth last year, he played that. And Alex Maniger must just be sitting in those meetings thinking, well, hang on, I'm the goalkeeper as well. Why aren't I getting spoken about? Is he just turning up to Melwood and then going home again and without doing anything? I honestly don't know why we've signed Alex Maninger. Unless it's a coach thing, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, his experience could be good for coaching, and a lot of people did touch on that when he initially came. But, you know, as you say, he's not even around the club. If he was going to go into a coaching role, he would be there. He would be looking at how things are run and be looking to, you know, bounce off it. But he's not doing that. And I think it sort of highlights the amount of dead wood still in the club. You know, Conor Randall is another one, particularly annoys me. Putting him in the same bracket as Conor Randall might be a little bit harsh. But
Conor Randall would have scored.
dare I say it, Lucas, for Deadwood?
No, what? Not for me.
What?
No, what? Lucas has a role to play.
Tremendous on Sunday, Lucas.
He was excellent, but like he's not good enough to consistently be a defensive midfielder at the club. He's not. He's not been good enough. He's not been good enough for years.
We've got a very, very young team, and he's a very experienced player. He's showing his experience. And a lot of people, when the lineup came out at the weekend, were saying, why are you prioritising Lucas over Joe Gomez? But it was a case of experience, and for me, that says it all.
Can I go off topic and talk about Joe Gomez for a second?
Yeah.
I don't understand this. I think it's what happens when people get injured. Actually, Lucas is the same, similar to this, when he got injured for about 10 months or so. Joe Gomez, before this season, had played 5 Liverpool games.
And people all at left back.
And people were talking about him like he was Beckenbauer. He's played 5 games for Liverpool, then people were talking about him like he's the great white hope of English football.
I remember I've literally seen people say, why is Lovren starting ahead of Joe Gomez? And I'm just like, what? You're talking... Lovren is a good centre-back, and you want to play a kid who's never played a Premier League game at centre-back ahead of him? They act as if... It's not just the fact that they think it's an idea. It's the fact they say it as if it's the most obvious thing in the world, and anyone who thinks otherwise is stupid. They make it sound as if, you know, Joe Gomez not starting ahead of Lovren is some sort of abomination. And it's like, the lads... And they say, like, if we're not going to throw him into, you know, Premier League games as centre-back, when do we do it? I mean, we tested him in a couple of games in the FA Cup. He got fun. Wolves ran rings around him when absolutely he started at centre-back there.
Which is fine because he's a kid, and you know. But
yeah, exactly.
But you know, don't criticise Jürgen. Don't do that. And Jürgen's done the right thing, and he's done the same thing with Ojo as well. He's just said, okay, well, I've seen you. I'm taking you out. You're not quite ready for this level. That's what a good manager does. And I'm happy with that. But I went to see Charlton a few times the year before we signed them. So Joe Gomez played about. I've seen him play about 5 or 6 times, and. I left that ground thinking about Charlton's defence, because I had to write about Charlton at the time. I like their right back. I can't even remember Joe Gomez. I thought the right back was good. Chris Sully, I think his name was. But I remember thinking he was all right. Not for us, but you know, just generally he was quite good at that level. And Joe Gomez had no impression on me whatsoever. That's not to say Joe Gomez is a bad player. And for God's sake, please, no one think that I'm saying that. But I had enough hate mail on Sunday. But... Yeah, but we just do this thing, and it's just extraordinary sometimes about people thinking, you know, they don't look at the context of where a player is in his development and, you know, what's expected of them.
I think for me it's about the you know, the pressure that we put on youngsters immediately. We want them to be the next star in the making. We want them to be the next big thing, and we've seen it happen. Yeah, we've seen it happen with Sterling. We've seen it. Well, it started to happen with Woodburn already. You know, every time he comes in, he's almost expected to do something amazing. It's also started to happen with Alexander Arnold. I think he's a great player. I think Woodburn and him have very bright futures. But, you know, Klopp being asked about them in press conferences, all the talk is always about them. It's too much pressure for young people. And even, you know, a couple of days ago, people were calling for Ryan Brewster to come into the first team. He's had a couple of good performances. He's obviously a very talented player, but that's just far, far too much pressure to be put on young people.
I'll give you an example. I didn't go to the Stoke game. I heard I was watching it on Sky, and I watched the show they show on Sky where they play about an hour of the game rather than just highlights. And when they did like the analysis afterwards, they criticised. They said about Jürgen, he said he took off Trent and they took off Woodburn. That's a kick in their teeth for their confidence, isn't it? I thought, are you insane? They'll be elated to be on the pitch because they know where they are. You know, they know where they're, you know, they're not. We're not going to start dropping Nathaniel Clyne just yet. We're not going to start dropping Coutinho for Ben Woodburn. That's not knocking their confidence. He's basically saying, all day, one of this will be yours, but not today. We need to win the game, and these two lads will come on and they'll win the game, which they did.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it just makes you think straight through. Oh yeah, but as if you've got to start playing them immediately. No, you don't. It's for example the way Hulé looked after Michael Owen. He sat him on the bench for like 4 games or something, and just didn't bring him on. He just like wanted you to get used to the thought that you might be on the pitch, and he did it gradually like that. Not every young player is Steven Gerrard.
Yeah, I think we'll wrap it up there. Just because we're getting slightly off topic, but also, you know, that conversation could go on for ages. You know, as you said, not everyone's the next Steven Gerrard, but everyone wants players to be the next Steven Gerrard, so they're constantly looking.
And if they don't play, they are the next Steven Gerrard.
Yeah, exactly. So big thanks to Carl for coming on today. It was really good to talk to you and to discuss your article.
Thank you. Enjoyed that.
And my co-host Tom, obviously. So if you guys have any plugs, anything coming up for you, Carl?
Oh God, I do this so often, but I have a football book out with Sasha Nakrani called We're Everywhere Us, which is about the 2015 season, but not about football. It's about what makes you become a Liverpool fan and what you do on match day. I have a novel called And What Do You Do? And this is incredibly off topic, but at the moment I'm writing a 10-week series about the Jack the Ripper murders of 1888. I know you're all going to be over it now I've said this. There's an obvious link between Alberto Moreno and the Whitechapel murders. But I'm writing that. It's called 10 Weeks in Whitechapel.
Sounds great. And for you, Tom, anything on the horizon?
Nope, just going to be, you know, plugging away, doing my articles for this and my match reviews. Check out my match reviews if you don't read them. They're over on Anfield HQ and obviously all my articles on Anfield Index. And of course, I'll be back here with you when we're doing this in a week or two as well.
Perfect. All right. Thanks for both coming on.
Thank you.
Cheers, Leanne.
Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the Anfield Index Writers Podcast.
Podcast Network.